Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps, sitting in for Jim Fleming. We've counted down the minutes and celebrated the passing of another year. Now it's time to open up a new calendar and start the clock all over again. We pay close attention to the passage of time, don't we? With calendars, day timers, watches, clocks, second hands. Would it comfort you to know that the universe also keeps track of time?
This is the moment when the universe would begin to reflect upon itself in conscious self-awareness. The universe knows what time it is.
In this hour, a cosmologist tells us that the universe just might have masterminded its own creation. And novelist Jim Crace wonders what the end of time might look like.
In the same way that we, humankind, can be lacking in understanding of the natural world and inflict damage on the natural world in the careless way that we have, then the natural world can do the same back to us.
First, we surround ourselves with devices designed to keep time and to keep us on schedule. But cosmologist Brian Swim says our fixation with artificial time, clock time, may be interfering with a more profound awareness of the nature of time. He believes cosmology holds the key to getting us back into right relation with the cosmos. Steve Paulson asked Brian Swim how to get back in touch with the organic movement of our planet.
Do you pay much attention to the sun?
I do. I try to organize my day around the... we say the rising of the sun and the setting of the sun. One of the most accessible ways that we can approach this is to realize that the sun is not rising. I think it's one of the great challenges to consciousness in our time.
Right, the sun isn't moving so much. It's the earth that's turning.
The earth is turning. And by greeting the sun in the morning, one can actually have the experience of the planet rolling, the planet spinning, the planet twirling. You can experience it very profoundly at dawn and dusk, but then during the day, you'll discover that you'll regularly return to this realization that we live on a planet and that we are soaring around this star that is a million times the size of Earth. That's one of the things I do is that in the morning time, when I'm reflecting on the sun, I simply will rehearse that. I'll simply tell myself, that sun I'm looking at is a million times the size of our planet. Hmm. And then so you begin to get a sense of its vastness.
Do you do anything to mark the end of the day, the coming of darkness?
Precisely the same thing. It's to, when possible, to just to say goodbye to the sun. And there's an amazing sense of sadness as I feel the earth roll away from the sun. You see, it's like there's a sadness of like, oh, that all of that excitement of being in the midst of that energy is ending now. And yet it's a sadness that's tinged with excitement because then we're rolling into the night. And the night is this cone of darkness that we enter into, the earth enters into. And so it's a way of remembering the night world as a different world. You know, the feelings we have in the night are different. One of the great sadnesses is to have night taken away from us because there are ways of knowing the world and the ways of knowing oneself and one's family and one's destiny that happen in the night, and they're qualitatively different than the daytime.
Well, it raises the question of whether cosmology can somehow give us back that sense of awe and wonder about the universe.
Well, I think it can. I really do. And in terms of time, one of the most amazing discoveries of cosmologists is that time at the level of the universe really is a measure of the quality of creativity.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, for instance, this is somewhat of a new idea, but it's worth reflecting on. I can just give you one example that the universe begins, like we say, 13.7 billion years ago. And then it flows forth with all of this energy. And then this amazing thing happens. At a certain point, the first atoms begin to form out of the elementary particles. Now, before this moment, there were no atoms. The first atoms that formed were hydrogen and helium. And what is really a stunning discovery is that this moment was the moment when hydrogen atoms would be created. So the entire universe changed form. It went from what we call plasma into a form of atoms. So that is a measure of time in terms of creativity. And then a later development took place when the atoms began to form stars and galaxies. So a galaxy consists of something like 100 billion stars. And once again, we have the same point, is that before this moment, the universe had no galaxies. And the amazing discovery is that there has not been a new galaxy constructed since that moment. So you see, it's like the time to create galaxies. Now, we talk about that as being a billion years after the birth of the universe. But the point I'm trying to make is that, in a way, we're only just beginning to explore. The universe knows what time it is in some deep, mysterious way.
Now, you've been talking about this very long view of time. I mean, really going back to the Big Bang of nearly 14 billion years ago. And I guess it raises the question of where we are in this this great cycle of time. And are we still near the beginning, or are we in the middle somewhere? Any thoughts about that?
Well, I have a thought, and it's slightly complicated, but if you just give me 30 seconds, maybe I can. One of the amazing things is called the law of large numbers, and it is, if you look at the ratio of the fundamental powers of the universe, like electromagnetism and gravity, what scientists have found, it's a puzzling discovery, but they found there's something special about this time we are in. And it shows up in the mathematics. And one scientist in particular came up with this interpretation, which I offer as speculation about our moment. And according to his thinking, that what is special about our moment is that this was the moment, not when life would come forth, or not when the galaxies would be created, or not when life would complexify into complex organisms, but rather, this is the moment when the universe would begin to reflect upon itself in conscious self-awareness. I have to repeat, it's speculation, but it does match the mathematics, and it's for some of us, it's kind of a thrilling idea that, what is the idea? The idea is that the universe has a sense of time and knows what it is about.
What does it mean then for the universe to somehow be conscious of itself?
If the universe knew in some strange way how to expand so that life could come forth, maybe, this is a speculation, that the universe was driving towards not just life, but a reflection upon itself. So how is this playing itself out on our planet? Well, it's within the human beings. We have begun to reflect upon the nature of life, and we have brought forth so much power, technological power, because of this. And it could be, you see, this is a suggestion, it could be that all of our technology and all of the science, all this power, is for some greater purpose. It's for the universe to enter into its evolutionary unfolding now with conscious self-awareness, whereas before that was absent.
Well, you haven't used the word God, but it sort of sounds like that maybe that's what you're referring to in some way. I mean, if you're talking about the universe as consciously reflecting back on itself.
You know, of course, to bring up God, then there would be all sorts of theological reflections from different cultures upon that. And that, I think, is very, very important, but I have no special knowledge about that.
So you're really, you're just talking about this in scientific terms.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so fascinating that we see we're beginning to see the universe as an organic entity or a reality that has its own intrinsic timing. And I think that the challenge for the human right now is to enter into this deeper cosmological rhythm. And the most obvious way is to invent a form of humanity that actually is an enhancement to the planet.
You're talking about actually humans evolving to some new stage. I mean, I think there's this general sense that we're kind of at the end of the line here. I mean, this is sort of who we're going to be. And but you're saying humans might become something rather different.
See, that I think is exactly the point, as you've said it, Steve, exactly. That we I would say that part of the way in which we still live on a flat Earth, right, and we think that the sun goes around the Earth, we still sort of think that on some level, unconsciously. Another way of saying that is that we also think that humans are fixed. So that what we're discovering is that everything in the universe is changing and evolving, everything. And so we certainly are part of that.
So do we have some responsibility in this to evolve? I mean, I don't know. We probably can't control this, but to evolve in some particular direction?
That, I think, is the crushing tragedy of our time in that, see, we've developed so much science and technology, and we've developed a civilization all for the human. In fact, it's only been for a subset of the human. And what I'm trying to suggest is, what if the human has a larger significance? What if really our significance includes the planet and the cosmos? That's the suggestion. And at the very least, what if we need to take seriously our responsibility for these powers as they affect other members of the Earth community?
So you're saying at the very least, we should be better ecological citizens to take care of this Earth.
And to see this as a vast gift, a privilege handed to us by the universe itself.
Brian Swim is a mathematical cosmologist at the Center for the Story of the Universe at the California Institute of Integral Studies. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Every culture has its own story about the origins of the universe. Thebe Medupe is an astrophysicist who grew up under apartheid in a small South African village. Today, Medupe works at the South African Astronomical Observatory, and he's also both the subject and the producer of a documentary called Cosmic Africa. It's an exploration of the astronomical legends of the Bushmen of the Kalahari and the Dogon people in Mali. Medupe grew up hearing his own village elders tell stories about the stars and the planets.
Up to the age of about 8 or 9, you know, we used to stay with my grandparents in our village, and every evening after dinner, we would sit around the fire and some people would go and sing and dance. And often also we would sit and listen to our grandparents telling us stories about the night sky.
What sort of stories did they tell?
For example, there was a story of how the different colors of the stars were formed one time many years ago when a girl saw her mother roasting roots on the fire, and she wanted to have the roots, although they were not ready yet, and she kept nagging her mother. And when her mother refused, you know, she was angry, and she picked up the burning roots and threw them up. And from the sparks and the different colors that come from the sparks when you throw the fire up came different colors of stars, you know.
Mm. How old were you when you fell in love with astronomy?
I was 13 years old. That was in 1986 when Halley's Comet visited our night sky in Southern Africa. Because of this, the newspapers and the radio talked a lot about the comet and also about astronomy. Our school, as a result, organized a theme week where all the subjects we did at school covered astronomy. And because of that, you know, I got inspired and I got curious to want to find more about astronomy. I went to our library, I read more about astronomy from astronomy books, and fortunately I came across a book on how to make a little telescope from material that you can easily find at home. I went to our school and I borrowed some lenses and I built myself a telescope at age 13. And with a telescope, I remember one chilly evening I pointed it to the moon and I was just captivated by the beauty of what I saw. I saw craters, I saw mountains and valleys on the moon with my little telescope that I built with my own hands. It was really, really special.
Tell me something about that journey you went on looking for, essentially, I guess, the ancient roots of African astronomy. You spent a bunch of months living with the Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert and also the Dogon people in Mali. What made you choose those particular people?
We selected those communities because they are living communities. We wanted our documentary to be a living documentary, which will show very clearly how traditional societies used to rely on stars for their day-to-day living. And the fascination with the Bushmen is that they are considered to be the world's oldest people. And therefore, the stories that we heard from them are some of the world's oldest stories. And really, it's beautiful. I mean, it connects us with our history very nicely.
Long, long ago, before stars and meteors, the Creator made the first fire. The Creator had two sons called Kanka and Koma. One day, Kanka and Koma went out hunting with a family of lions. But the treacherous lions ate the boys. In his anger and despair, the Creator made a fire. He put the fire into a meteor and disguised the meteor as eland horns. The Creator called the meteor down from the sky. The meteor killed the lions, so the Creator's heart was calmed, and there was fire for people on earth. Today we still see Kanka and Koma as two stars in the sky. They tell us when the year ends and when the year begins. They tell us about the future, the rainy season, and the beginning of winter.
Had you heard that story before? Was it new to you?
No, it was quite new. I mean, the best part I remember about the Bushmen was how amazing and fantastic storytellers were. I mean, when I was sitting there in the evenings listening to these old men and watching how animated they were as they were telling the stories, I kept thinking of my two children at home, you know, of how much lucky they would be to grow up in an environment where every evening they were taught how to link up with nature, and also in a very beautifully visual way that we witnessed with the Bushmen.
Hmm. Tell me about the Dogon people. What did they teach you about their connection with the sky?
Oh, the Dogons were really amazing. One evening I went out with the two old men to go and show me the different stars. And I asked one old man what was the most important star to his people. And he told me that the Pleiades, you know, those are the, some people call them seven sisters. It's a cluster of stars which are held together by gravity. So the Pleiades, according to this man, was the most important star to his people. And so just to check how much he knows about the Pleiades, I asked him to give him the times of the days and the different times in the year when the Pleiades can be seen, whether in the morning or in the evening. And the old man told me all of this. So I went to my laptop and checked, and I ran a software to check whether what he was telling me was true. And he was spot on. He was very, very correct, because indeed, I mean, he puts a lot of effort into studying the movement and positions of the stars.
The diviner builds his map with the symbols of the sun and moon. He shapes the constellations and the elements of the earth. He prays to the stars for guidance. Then he sprinkles ground nuts to lure the jackal to walk the map. During the night, the paw prints left on the map will give answers to the diviner's questions.
When you were spending time with the Bushmen and with the Dogon people, and you were asking for their stories about the stars and the planets and what they knew, did you ever in turn share your knowledge of the cosmos with them?
Well, we thought hard about that, but then we decided that to a large extent we wouldn't do it, because I went there primarily as a student to learn about their knowledge. And we didn't want to confuse them with the things that we know, and we certainly didn't want to impose our belief systems on theirs. So really it was just purely us learning their system.
There is one moment of conflict between the traditional cosmologies and your Western scientific cosmology. There's a moment when you're watching a solar eclipse with the Bushmen, I think.
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, tell me what happened.
Okay, so a couple of days before the eclipse, we asked them questions about eclipses. And from there, they told us that, you know, according to them, eclipses are bad things. They associate eclipses with evil spirits, especially with the lion being the most feared and hated animal among the Bushmen. So then when a couple of days later the eclipse happened, they started suspecting us, you know, how can normal human beings, according to them, be able to predict or know about the coming of an eclipse? And so because of that, they were not happy with us. They thought that we were bringing evil things, evil spirits, to the village.
Nai is saying that it looks like something has broken the sun, like a piece is broken off. Why is the sun going blind? The telescope is eating the sun. The ones who eat the sun live in the West. They change into lions. The owners of torment are coming.
So what effect did it have on you to spend time with the Bushmen, with the Dogon people, and to find these kind of deep roots to your own astronomy?
It was a very humbling experience. I mean, to know that the apartheid system and the colonialism system has tried to hide away information that could be empowering to us, and that I've been lucky enough that I've had access to this information. And I was very, very much inspired to make sure that this information doesn't die with these communities, and that this information finds its ways in a form of a film, and also, secondly, in a form of books that would be easily accessible to our young people, so that they also rejoice in knowing that their ancestors, just like other people's ancestors, were very truly curious about the night sky, and they also had their own belief systems associated with stars and so on, just like everyone else on Earth.
So they can have a sense that astronomy, that studying the stars, studying the planets, is just as African as it is Western?
That's correct, yeah. I mean, to me, that is the biggest lesson I've obtained from this journey, was that truly science is a human activity. Science belongs to all of us. No one should ever tell you otherwise, you know. Yeah.
I'm climbing on a thread into the sky towards the moon. My path is filled with fire, bright and shining. I feel a wind on my face as I fly. It is a person's soul. This wind, that tense, that changes. The owners of torment are dangling in the sky, and I drive them back. My ancestors guide me well on the shining road. They take me back along the same road, so that I can enter my body and be well. And then I know I have spoken with God, and my heart is happy.
Thebe Medupe is a professor of ethnoastronomy at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. His documentary is called Cosmic Africa. I'm Anne Strainchamp, sitting in for Jim Fleming. You're listening to the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. We've been talking about the beginning of time. Let's head now to the end. Award-winning British novelist Jim Crace says the job of fiction is to imagine the unimaginable. Take, for instance, the apocalypse. In his book, The Pest House, Crace envisions a post-apocalyptic America, a world laid low by eco-disaster and social collapse. He told Jim Fleming that our current conditions make it all too easy to imagine the worst sort of future.
All times in history, we've had a sense that the world is unblemished and will remain unblemished forever, that it's untouchable, that it's here for eternity. But at the same time, we are fearful of the oddities in the way that people in the medieval times would be terrified by an eclipse of the sun, because we rely on things that we don't understand. And when something we don't understand, such as the sun, disappears for 24 hours or whatever it is, for an hour or so during a total eclipse, then that can be terrifying. We, of course, understand the nature of the universe much more, not entirely, but much more now. But there are still new things to frighten us. What is certain is that in the 21st century, we are besieged by different versions of how the world could end or change drastically and how that could happen soon. You know, we're told about things like nuclear meltdown. We're quite used to that over the last 70 years. But there are new things that we've added to that. Global warming. Finally, America and Europe, but America particularly, has recognized that global warming is galloping us towards problems. And there are other things, such as contagions and pandemics. Now, I know that in the medieval times, people took those in their stride. They expected there to be black deaths and choleras. Modern medicine has rescued us from those things largely. But look at the way in which AIDS now affects 40% of the people in Botswana and Lesotho. And I heard a scientist saying that if avian flu is able to cross species and the number of deaths is equal to the number of deaths, you know, the same proportion as the number of the deaths that happened in 1919, the last time avian flu affected the United Kingdom, then 19 million people in the United Kingdom could die.
Let's talk about your story then, this story, yeah. This future that you've created. I don't think it's giving anything away to say that this is America at some unspecified future date, clearly far enough in advance that the disaster occurred well before the beginning of the story. No one really remembers it, although close enough to that, I gather that the artifacts can still be found regularly of the time before the disaster, whatever it was.
Well, how long does it take anything to rot away? How long does it take a hulk of a ship to be reduced to something which looks almost natural? Probably 80 or 90 years. I mean, we know that polystyrene cups are going to still be there untouched in 1,000 years. But yes, you're quite right. I would say probably 100 years after now is what we're talking about.
And the people who have survived this now live with very little memory of that time. There seems to be almost no history for them.
Well, if you imagine a huge depopulation of America for one reason or another, we don't know what it's going to be, whether it's a pandemic or whatever it is. If you imagine a huge depopulation and a sudden one, even if that depopulation is worldwide, the effects on developed nations such as America and Britain is going to be greater than the effects on somewhere like the Sudan or a remote island in Indonesia. The reason is that our advanced civilizations are so separated from the natural world that we wouldn't know how to find and forage. We wouldn't know how to make rafts. Our ingenuity has failed to keep us informed about how to make fire or shelters, you know, with the help of a building company or safety matches. And so it would not be surprising if there was a collapse of population in the United States of America, given the size of the United States of America, if the infrastructure just collapsed. So that's the starting point. But what this book is not trying to do is to say this is a likely outcome for America. That's not the point about this book. This is not a book about America 200 years down the line or 100 years down the line saying this is a likely scenario. All this is a metaphor. It's a metaphor for what I'm concerned about the American condition now. It's about our Western unconcern for the planet. It's about the dangers of being on the top of the pile and coping with being at the bottom of the pile. It's about the American dream and whether the American dream has become blemished in the same way as the American landscape has become blemished.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the dream. I mean, I think we all know what the American dream is supposed to be now. You better yourself. In some ways, the dream of your characters is the same, and perhaps what you're saying is that their dream is not much different from ours. It's to attain something that they don't understand at all.
The American dream, it seems to me, is based on something very simple, and it's what accounts for the fact that even though when they carried out an opinion poll in the Middle East just after the beginning of the Iraq War, they asked the question, which country in the world do you most despise? And 84%, I think, said America, predictably, you know, in the circumstances. But later down the opinion poll, they said, which country in the world would you most like to emigrate to? And 83%, you know, only lost 1% of those, said the United States of America. Now, this, in an odd way, it tells us about the whole ambiguity of the world's relationship with America. Why is it that America, even though the people who despise America politically, their foreign policy anyway, why is it that they still want to come here? It's because the American narrative is one of delivering on hopes, on coming up with the acre of land when you've never owned land, on giving the job when the Dust Bowls have robbed you of them, of giving you the Hollywood dream if you meet the West Coast. It's a dreaming narrative. American is based on a dreaming narrative, it seems to me. And that dreaming narrative is one which I, as an Englishman, have always bought into. Because the English narrative is entirely different. The English narrative is squeamish and stuttering and blushing. And it doesn't take any risks and it doesn't head out for the frontier. And even if it did head out for the frontier, there'd be no wilderness to encounter. So there's something very basic about the appeal of that press westward, the family with the kids on the mother's breast and the bucket and the cow tied to the back of the wagon, which in a way is beyond destruction. However, it feels that we've lost an image of that. We've lost that because when people now think about America, they don't think of those things. They think of something which is blemished. So my book is about investigating the blemish and revisiting the dream.
We should talk about where your book begins. It is in this future America, and the characters about whom we will care the most are Franklin and Margaret, going not west, as you suggest, but east, in the hope that they will reach the sea and be taken to some promised land. Maybe we ought to know a little bit more about Franklin and Margaret. And if you would, I wonder if you would read a little bit to describe Franklin for me.
In what remained of the slanting light, Franklin Lopez tried to sleep while facing east, downhill. The closeness of Ferrytown was a comfort to him. From his high vantage point, he had seen the busy little lanes and yards and watched the ferry, its raft boards packed with the day's last emigrants and their suddenly weightless possessions, as it was let out on its fat ropes to drift downstream, never quite capsizing, until the four helmsmen dug in their great oars and poles to bring the craft ashore in the shallows of the deeply gravelled landing beach. He had then watched the ferry, unladen, but now set against the river, being towed back upstream by a team of oxen on a winch, and beached for the night at the mooring. He had seen the first lamps lit, and heard what sounded like a song. Surely Franklin could not wish for a prospect more reassuring or more promising than this. Once the moon came up, above the leaden volumes of clouds, augmenting what was left of day, the lake in the valley, hidden up till then in mist, was like a silver pendant, with the river as its glinting chain. Franklin had not seen so much standing water before. Perhaps the sea would be like that, flat and safe and breathtaking.
It's disturbing, don't you think, that Franklin takes so much comfort in being close to Ferrytown, this place that we know by this time is going to be a place of death? Or is that just another part of this exploration you're making of the way in which our dreams aren't necessarily what we think they are?
Well, we take human comfort in things, but nature doesn't always play along. You know, it's a natural disaster that kills off the people in Ferrytown. In my books, there's always a tension that exists between the natural world and the so-called civilized world. And my books are always trying to mediate them. The natural world can be sour. The natural world can be full of putrefaction. The natural world can be unnecessarily shocking and cruel. So if we're going to get any mediation between those two things, we might as well admit the truth about it. In the same way that we, humankind, can be lacking in understanding of the natural world and inflict damage on the natural world in the careless way that we have, then the natural world can do the same back to us.
And this pest house, it's more attractive than it ought to be. In some ways, it turns out the pest house is the rock on which the rest of the story is built.
The pest house is America. The pest house is where you go to recover. There are such things. This book started, actually, with me discovering a real pest house on the Isles of Scilly, 35 miles off the coast of Cornwall, where I spend a lot of time, 140 islands there, of which only five are inhabited, and there's one uninhabited one, which in the 18th century was used as a quarantine station for people travelling to the United Kingdom. If you had so much as acne or rosacea or something, people would suspect it would be cholera, and they'd stick you in this pest house until you recovered. Of course, you wouldn't recover because there's already someone there that had got cholera, so you'd catch it and you'd die. And when I saw that, I thought, wow, what a fantastic title for a book. But I also realized that there was an important subject matter there, and the subject matter was emigration and our need to leave home to realize our hopes by going abroad to find those hopes. But hopes dashed, because here would be people traveling on a boat, and simply because they had a red cheek, even though they were within 35 miles and in sight of the cliffs of Cornwall, they would be stuck into the pest house and they would die. So that was the starting point of the book. At that point, when I encountered that story and that actual building, the subject matter of America was not one that I thought would fit into it. It was only when I became conflicted in my own attitudes towards America, you know, after 9/11 and after the Iraq War and after many, many visits here, that I realized that they were all of a piece.
And the pest house must hold some hope for you as well. In this story, it certainly does. Margaret survives the pest house, builds a future on having been yes. in the pest house.
The hope is this, that optimism and hope are found in dark places. An optimism which is found, you know, in a well-lit Hollywood studio is not an optimism worth having. An optimism which is found in a religion which tells you that when you die, you know, you're merely going to spend eternity with heaven. It's such an infantile optimism that it's worthless. I'm an immensely optimistic person. And the optimism that I find in my books, although most people don't recognize it as optimism, is optimism which is as hard as granite because it's come from a tough place. So what I'm saying, I think, in this book is that we all have to go through the pest house, or what that represents, the metaphor of the pest house. America as a nation has to go through the pest house. Britain has and will continue to have to go through pest houses in order to experience the furnace that life provides and in order to come out stronger.
Jim Crace is an award-winning writer, author of Being Dead, Quarantine, and most recently, The Pest House. He spoke with Jim Fleming. By the way, if you have questions or comments or want to find out more about the people behind the microphone, you can visit our website. It's ttbook.org. Or join us on Facebook. It's always nice to know who's listening. I'm Anne Strainchamps, in today for Jim Fleming, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. For most of us, the far distant past and the uncertain future are just part of the inherent mystery of life. We shrug our shoulders and accept the inscrutability of it all because we don't really have a choice. Or do we? Ron Mallett, a theoretical physicist at the University of Connecticut, has another option in mind: time travel. Mallett writes serious professional journal articles on theories of time travel, but he also wrote a more popular book about his own personal quest to travel back in time. It's called Time Traveler. In it, he traces his longing to change the course of time to a personal childhood tragedy.
It was actually when I was 10 years old. My father, he was a wonderful person, and for me, the sun rose and set on him. But no one knew just how ill he was. He looked like a very robust person, and he died suddenly of a heart attack. He was only 33 years old. And it completely destroyed my world. And I went from being a rather happy kid to rather depressed kid. But one of the gifts that he left me was a love for reading. And shortly after he died, I came across H.G. Wells' book, The Time Machine. It was like, oh, wow, this is it. This is the answer. Because I thought if I could build a time machine, then I could see him again. I could go back into the past and see him again.
And actually save his life?
That's right. So that became my holy grail. My goal was to try to build a time machine to see him again and tell him what was going to happen and maybe keep him from dying. So that was actually the beginning of my interest in time travel. The thing that you might say solidified for me, though, was a couple of years later, I came across a popular level book about Einstein. And in that book, it said that time was not something that was absolute. Time could be changed. So that meant to me that what H.G. Wells had said could could be true. And so I really knew that this is what I had to do, was to try to understand Einstein so that I could build this time machine.
So how did you wind up becoming a theoretical physicist?
What happened is that when I got out of high school, we were poor. After my father died, the family was very poor, and college was not something that was automatically in the picture. And I knew that if I wanted to go to college, I was going to have to get the money. So I decided to go into the service. So I became an enlisted man in the Air Force, and I worked on electronic computers. And it was actually during that time that I changed, because all of a sudden I realized that it was going to be physics. I actually fell in love with this thing called quantum theory. I mean, people have heard about it, okay? And it said the strange thing that the electron could do, that it could be everywhere and it could pass through walls. And I wanted to know about the people who could do that. And I read that they were theoretical physicists.
So you wound up doing your graduate work and you got your degree and you began moving up the academic ladder as a physicist. What happened to your interest in time travel during those years?
The thing is that even when I was a kid, I knew that people were concerned about me because I was in this depressed state. And so I was astute enough to realize not to tell them that I was wanted to build a time machine, because I didn't want to think about dealing
really
with the consequences
of that.
Exactly. And, of course, when I was going up the academic ladder, you know, I thought, if I tell my colleagues I'm interested in building a time machine, right, I'm going to get tenure, forget it. You know?
So, but was it something you were still thinking about? Or had progressed so far in physics, you'd put the idea of time travel away?
Oh, no. See, the thing is that what I did was I developed a cover plan. You have to realize that in physics, physics is a strange, strange beast. There's what people call legitimate crazy ideas, and then there's what people call crazy, crazy ideas. Now, black holes were legitimate crazy. In other words, in black holes, it turns out that black holes are connected with Einstein's work, and black holes are connected with time. I'll explain that. It turns out that a black hole is a star. It's a star that has collapsed to a point where the gravity around the star is so great that all the light that tries to escape from the star gets pulled back to the star. But now, a black hole also does something strange to time. It turns out that if you take a clock, the closer you get to a black hole, the more time slows down. And if you get near the edge of a black hole, you can actually bring time nearly to a halt. And this slowing down of time actually means that if you understood more about a black hole, you could control time, and that would form a sort of a time machine. So this meant that by studying black holes, I could study about time, and then I could also be considered legitimate crazy.
Well, so during all these years, what kind of progress did you make secretly on the side in your understanding of time?
Well, the thing is that if you look at black holes, rotating black holes, it turns out that there's a property associated with them that they cause space and time to be dragged around, and that it's a possibility with a rotating black hole of actually finding loops in time that can allow you to go into the past. So I realized that Einstein's theory was the key, that if I understood more about Einstein's theory of gravity, his general theory of relativity, then this might allow me to have a time machine that could go back into the past.
Slow down. So the key to this sounds like it's making a time loop?
How do you make
a time loop?
In a way, you can actually think of space as being like a substance, even though we think of it as being completely empty. In Einstein's theory, you can actually think of it as a substance.
Like fabric.
Like a fabric, that's right. But you could also think of it in a way as being like liquid. And in my work, the key to it was the fact that I thought about what rotating black holes did. They could rotate and they could twist space around them. Let's suppose that you think of empty space as being like coffee in a cup, okay? Mm-hmm. Then you take your spoon and you stir the coffee, it swirls around. Well, a rotating black hole can do that to empty space. It can cause space to swirl around. My breakthrough, which came through much later, was to realize that in Einstein's theory, something else could do that too, and that's light. We don't think of light as having an effect, a gravitational effect, but it does. You might say, well, how am I going to get light to be like rotating black hole or rotating object? Well, suppose that you have a square in front of you, and suppose that you put a mirror at each corner of the square, and suppose you send a light beam, a laser beam, down from one corner of the mirror to the other corner of the mirror. It reflects off the mirror there and goes over to the other corner, reflects off of that mirror, goes up to the other corner, reflects off of that, and then comes back to the original corner. You can see the light beam was going around the square.
Mm-hmm.
That would create what's known as a circulating light beam. Mm-hmm. Okay, this light beam going around. Now, the space that's within that square will actually get twisted around just like the coffee in a cup. In other words, the circulating laser beam will act like a spoon. The space inside will act like coffee. Okay, so the circulating light beam will actually cause that empty space to get swirled around just like coffee in a cup.
And because Einstein says that space and time are really the same thing or kind of together, then time is swirling too?
Yes, exactly, exactly. Normally we think of time as sort of a straight line, okay? Mm-hmm. We're at the bottom of the line, you know, is the past yesterday. The middle of the line is like the present today. And the top of the line is like the future. But if time is getting swirled around, then time can be bent into a loop. That means that you can actually move from the future back into the past.
Is this all, I mean, this is the kind of thing physicists talk about, and it's very, very fun to speculate about and to hear about. But is it pure theory, or could it actually be physically real?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, we're looking for funding in order to do that. In other words, I'm a theoretical physicist. I have an experimental colleague. His name is Chandroy Chowdhury. He's a specialist in lasers at the University of Connecticut. He's a professor of physics. And he became interested in trying to verify my work. And so we've been working closely together, and he has come up with experimental designs to test and prove my theories.
This just sounds amazingly exciting, but how far could you take the practical applications? I mean, let's say you get all your funding, and in fact, you prove that you can send a subatomic particle back a nanosecond in time. Does it mean that we could ever really send people back in time? I mean, getting back to your dream of traveling in time?
You know, we're not trying to do it with people, of course, at this particular stage. That may happen, right? We're trying to prove the principle.
Don't you get caught in an endless time loop?
Now, see, that's precisely the thing that comes up with the notion of time travel, is this fact that if I change something in the present, then I change the future. And there's two things that you have to realize with respect to that, because that leads to the notion of these paradoxes that can occur. You know, the most famous one being the so-called grandfather paradox, which says that suppose a time traveler goes back into the past and they prevent their grandfather from meeting their grandmother somehow. Then if they do that, then their grandparents, of course, don't have their parents.
So then you've wiped yourself out.
Right. And so how did you go back and do that? That's called the grandfather paradox, okay? But there's two different ways in which you can view that. Once again, it comes back to this notion of quantum theory. We cannot predict exactly what's going to happen next in quantum theory. All we can say is what is probably going to happen. One aspect of quantum theory is that if you apply it to the entire universe, it leads to the possibility that there is actually not just simply our universe, but there is actually parallel universes. These other universes look very much like our universe, but they're different. They occur whenever any particular decision is made in our universe. Let me give you an example. Suppose that at lunch today, you were trying to make a decision between whether to have a fish sandwich or cheeseburger. At that particular point, according to quantum theory, there would be a split of the universe. There would be a you that had the cheeseburger and a you that had the fish sandwich. Now, these two universes are real and independent of each other and separate. Now, this doesn't have to do with just simply human decisions. I mean, if you have an electron that has two possible paths, according to this, it takes both paths but in different universes. So this is the notion of parallel universes, that there's a split of the universe into other universes for every decision that has to be made. Now, how does this apply to time travel? Now we go back to this grandfather paradox situation. When the time traveler goes back into the past, at the instant they get back into the past, there's a split in the universe. They arrive in a branch of the universe in which, in fact, they can prevent their grandparents from meeting each other, and their grandparents don't have their parents. They will find themselves, or time traveler will find themselves in a strange universe in which they've never been born, but they will be there. However, remember that when they went back into the past, there was a split. The other universe is the branch that they actually originally came from, and they aren't in that branch, and so they don't affect the past, and that branch leads to the time traveler.
So the time machine actually lets you not just travel in time, but between universes.
Exactly, exactly. And so the upshot is that you can travel back in time and change the past, but the past you change is not the past that you came from. And so there is no paradox here because you're not changing the original universe you came from.
Mind-bending possibilities from Ron Mallet. He's a theoretical physicist at the University of Connecticut, and his book is called Time Traveler.
Einstein called it spooky action at a distance.
Poet Fleta Brown.
I'm rubbing my nose. And what are you doing now, dear one? What parts are we putting together? I dragged you into this. What age is like, really? I had no idea. Turns out, the present settles into its nest of memories and likes it there, even when it stings. Let me start over. I am walking North Intermediate Lake Road on October 7th, not long till your birthday, sun on spider webs, stop signs of dew and sun, one after the other, strung across stalks, a bloom field of sun changes with their studious lines to the center. Time's turned out to be my subject. It's climbed the ladder of my attention, spinning its internal juices, never using itself up. It hasn't been pushy. It's begun to feel like my best friend. Let me start over. Memory's not as easy as I said. It muscles horribly upwards sometimes, bigger than I am, carrying nasty details in its arms. I keep eating them like a spider, so not everything will come your way. I like to think of you where you are right now, driving kids to school in Massachusetts. I'm walking the lake road in Michigan, watching leaves turn and burn in the eye of time. How dear it is to me, the way it holds you in its sun-dazzled arms as you round a curve and break at the sign, squinting your dozen little wrinkles.
That's Fleta Brown reading from her lovely poem, For My Daughter's 40th Birthday. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Jim Fleming will be back next week. You're listening, of course, to Charlie Parker's classic, Now's the Time. And now is the time to mention that if you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, find the title of a piece of music, or send a link to a friend. You can do all that at our website. It's www.ttbook.org. You can also stream audio there or download a podcast. And if you actually want to buy a hard copy of The Hour on CD, you can call the radio store. That number is 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 100103B, also known as The Course of Time. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Aaron Kloon, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, and Mary Lou Finnegan. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson, and our time-traveling, time-warping technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.